Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when a soldier leaves the battlefield physically but cannot leave it behind psychologically? Roger Benimoff served two tours of duty in Iraq as a chaplain for the U.S. Army. He approached the job filled with faith, confidence, and a clear sense of purpose. But after enduring loss after loss, death after death in Iraq, by the time he returned home, he could hardly muster any of the three. Even as he accepted an assignment to minister to returning veterans at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, he himself was suffering barely controllable rage, he was distant from his family, and shaken by anxiety that medication barely touched. He had a severe and classic case of post-traumatic stress disorder. So what has it taken to start healing the soldier and his family? And what can his story teach us about how to care for other veterans whose mental wounds may be even more painful than their physical ones? Roger Benimoff talks about it in his new book, Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. Roger, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you.
How did you make the decision to be an Army chaplain?
I had always been involved in the military. I enlisted in the military out of high school. And when I decided to get out and go to college and go to seminary, it had been something that had been with me, a desire. Colleges, different organizations, they have ministries that cater to them, but what does the military have? What do the young 18-year-olds have? What kind of influence? What type of influence? And so going through seminary and going through my National Guard training at the time, I really sensed just a peace about entering the ministry, serving God, and serving country, which had always been a part of my life.
So was there a particular process that you went through before you were deployed the first time to sort of prepare yourself spiritually and psychologically for the work?
Not at all. I was on active duty about 3 weeks, brand new Army captain, when I went to Iraq for the first time. I thought I was just coming on active duty. One of my senior chaplains had given me an idea that there's a possibility of you going to Iraq, but not so quick and not so swift. I met my unit in Iraq, didn't have any experience with them. They were going through several deaths of soldiers that were dying in theater in Iraq. And that was my first taste of being in the Army and being with a unit, an Army unit.
I hate to use the phrase because it's so trite, but I can't get baptism under fire out of my head.
Yeah, I knew it was a God-sized task. I walked into both deployments with the soberness of, you know, I've got to seek God in every step, because it was so overwhelming to walk into an environment where people who wear the same uniform as you, they're dying, you're traveling the same roads as they are, getting shot at, and being in that type of environment necessitates either moving closer to God or moving further away from God.
Chaplains, I know, do not carry weapons. Was there a time when you thought you'd like to have something on you just in case?
My first trip outside the wire, my second deployment, we went to visit one of the local hospitals. And the hospital had been taken over by insurgents. The local Iraqis could not use the hospital for their own care. And so several platoons from my unit took over the hospital and secured it for the local population. When I went out with my commander the first time to the hospital, I was on the roof of the hospital visiting with several of my soldiers from a particular platoon in Fox Troop. We started to receive sniper fire, and that was my first taste of being outside the wire, and the best I could do was jump and hide behind a air conditioning duct, which was made out of aluminum.
I know that after a while, when you would be shot at, things became so crazy that there was a point at which you thought, I'm not even scared of this.
Yeah, in the moment, I did what I had to do. It was only after the second deployment, when I knew I wasn't going back, when I could take a deep breath and let my defenses down, that I started to feel the impact of being continuously in an environment where not only my soldiers' lives are threatened, but where I'm threatened, I'm trying to deal with their stuff, their grief, the unit's grief, and my own stuff at the same time.
You are a guy who has a wife and two kids. I wonder how often when you were in Iraq you thought, is it my right to possibly sacrifice myself when I've got people who depend on me?
Yeah, there's a myriad of emotions, everything from anger to sadness to sorrow to joy at the idea of getting to serve country, getting to be a part of something that's bigger than myself, that's part of history, and at the same time, conducting the memorial ceremonies for my soldier who was killed by a sniper and then subsequently blown up in his medic track as he was being evacuated, him not being able to be with his unborn child, not even being able to meet, and that was the case in many of the deaths, leaving behind wife, children, families, and then me trying to digest that idea of, this could be it. And after a while, the tension is so great. I saw it in my soldiers, saw it in myself after a while. You almost want it to be over with. You almost want to die so you can get out of that environment where day after day you don't know what's going to happen.
One thing that people may not think too much about, obviously they know that you're there to help soldiers who are stressed out and dealing with things on the battlefield and those who've been injured. But these men and women also bring very complicated lives with them from back home. And in many cases, things start to deteriorate in their absence. And so they're dealing with bad relationships and things that would be stressful even if they were home working a 9-to-5 job.
A simple thing such as a broken hot water heater at the house becomes just a reminder of the sense of helplessness that the soldier has as he or she is on the battlefield trying to do their jobs, going 12 to 18 hours a day, and then they call back home, and here's the spouse, something that would be simple, changing a tire, the car breaking down, becomes a big deal because, here's the spouse back home taking care of pretty much all the logistical elements, the finances, the kids, and trying to maintain their own sense, their perception of control as they try not to think about the inevitable of their loved one. And so this cyclical pattern, many times when the soldiers would call home, it would turn into arguments or disagreements. And you almost have to cut your emotions off when you're over there, and that invites difficulty connecting with your loved one.
Well, I have to imagine, in order to not be absolutely out of control, you have to sort of cauterize parts of yourself that were more sensitive.
Yeah, I knew after my first memorial ceremony in my first deployment that I was not going to make it through if I didn't maintain some sense of at least perceived control regarding my feelings. And after my 17th memorial ceremony and dealing with the grief of the unit, ministering to the unit, providing for their spiritual needs, it came to a point where, I never believe I can actually cut off my emotions, but they overflow. I became so full that it's hard not to be worn down, because I went into both deployments with the concept of, I've got to look toward God, and again it really wasn't until I got back where I realized how much anger I had toward God in my faith. The question really wasn't why do bad things happen to good people. That wasn't the question at all. It's more of why do bad things happen to the defenseless. The soldier who looks into the eyes of the suicide bomber as he detonates and blows up all these civilians, those are the sorts of images that humans were never meant to witness. And so it becomes a very multi-leveled process to unpack my stuff and unpack their stuff that I carried, that I witnessed, and enter into my faith, and use that to move closer to God. And I think how that helped was being real and not trying. I went through a period of time when I was at my worst in October 2006, where...
This is when you were already back.
This is when I was already back. I was at Walter Reed, been at Walter Reed for about 6 months, and the post-traumatic stress, the not sleeping at night, the nightmares, the just emotionally out of control was so bad that it was... I mean, I couldn't get along with my family. I couldn't communicate with my family, with my coworkers. And so it became a process of going from that denial to, you know what, God knows what I'm going through. And looking through the Old Testament and realizing that, you know, the psalmists, the different prophets, they were real with God. They said it how it was, and it was through entering into my humanity, being real, taking off that mask, where the healing started to begin.
Is there a relationship, do you think, between losing your faith, and I suppose you haven't lost it permanently, but losing your faith in God and losing your faith in other human beings?
Yeah, I think it was part of the issue was... I became very disenfranchised with humanity. The amount of hatred that humans can have toward others and how life, the sacredness of life can be discarded in a moment, and seeing the worst. And it emphasized to me how important life is, and the few moments we do have, how important relationships are. And that's one of the things that my soldiers were able to catch a glimpse of in the moment was, you know, you don't worry about paying your car insurance. You don't worry about the broken radio in the vehicle. It's about those things that matter most in life, both our relationship with God and our relationship with our loved ones, each other.
There's this fundamental principle for people of faith, which is that God made man in his own image. When you see men doing such horrendous things to each other, what does that make you think about God?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've often viewed God as a distant father, as an absent presence in my life. Where I've said, you know, if I had a child, I would not want that child to go through what I went through, and I would do everything within my means to protect that child. But allowing some space has allowed me to reframe that.
Former U.S. Army Chaplain Roger Benimoff is my guest. His new book is called Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. And you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Roger Benimoff. Currently, he is a chaplain at Methodist Hospitals of Dallas. He is a former chaplain for the U.S. Army and served two tours of duty in Iraq. His new book is called Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Roger, I know that ultimately your relationship with God changed, and now you'll talk back a lot more than you did in the past.
Yeah. I mentioned that I often viewed God as an absent father because of the intensity of the helplessness of going through day after day after day and seeing the carnage. But since then, I've been able to reframe that and see God as allowing me to voice my frustration, giving me the space, giving me the freedom to take off that mask and to share what many people who go through traumas, whether it's combat or not, feel like they can't share.
Did you ever think that you were at risk for PTSD?
Not at all. In fact, I was quite arrogant going into it. I had a lot of training in post-traumatic stress disorder. I taught my soldiers, went to specialized training in different centers. In fact, the place where I did my PTSD inpatient therapy, and that was during my time at Walter Reed, I'd been there 2 years before to be trained in a specialized therapy for PTSD. So when I started to see these symptoms after I was back the second time, part of my surprise, part of my anger was, you know, I can't control this. And I know all about this, and yet I can't do anything about it. It's the emotions are the one thing that aren't controllable in that sense.
Had you, before you experienced it yourself, sort of thought anyone who has this condition should be able to, if not snap back, with a lot of hard work, sort of put things to right relatively easily?
Yeah, you know, part of my story, I've always taken pride in what I've done. I put myself through the Army, through college, through seminary, family, I've always been able to do and get through a problem. And the problem with that is becoming very self-dependent and losing sight of where God is in that relationship. And that is one aspect that I was quickly reminded of time after time when I saw the out-of-control nature of what I was going through. It was... Just to give you a quick illustration, my wife and I were in Maryland when we were at Walter Reed, and we were having a very heated discussion. I can't even remember what it was about, but we were in our house in Maryland. I remember it was sunny outside, and I turned away to walk away because I knew I was just boiling over. I knew that much about the rage that I was feeling. And she went just gently to grab my arm and just turn me around to continue the conversation. And all of a sudden, I wasn't in the house anymore. I was back in Iraq. I could smell the sand in the desert. And, you know, didn't hit her, didn't do anything violent. But I remember just being so emotionally out of control that that flashback was very vivid, and that's just one of many examples of not only what I went through, but what returning soldiers go through. That you can't just turn off the emotions.
And one of the things that you've had to learn, and I know it's not an overnight process, is to identify the things that will set you off. And I guess it makes sense that your body learns that anytime you're in extreme stress, it takes you back to that place. So even if it's stress of being in an argument with your wife or getting in a bad traffic situation, it zaps you back there.
That's exactly right. One of the helpful things about my time getting a specialized PTSD therapy inpatient was learning about what I would call my triggers, the things that do set me off. And that's one of the things that I believe would be helpful for returning soldiers to learn more about themselves, to not deny what they're going through, but to be real and to seek those relationships around them and learn about their triggers, because that's half the battle right there, knowing what type of situations you can avoid so that you don't make the ones around you suffer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Former U.S. Army Chaplain Roger Benimoff is my guest. His new book is called Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. Let's go to Ken in Parker County. Hey, Ken.
Hello. I was going to say something a little bit different, but your chaplain mentioned something that was an identical situation to mine. He commented about having discussion with his wife and turned to get out of the discussion to leave, and she touched him, and unfortunately I'm glad that his turned out without any violent response, but mine didn't. That's why I'm no longer married to that woman. I shouldn't say woman, my first wife. And the thing is I did two tours, so I understand two tours in Vietnam. I understand the multiple tour syndrome, but my question is, do you understand how long PTSD goes? Because I wasn't diagnosed until 1984, and I walked away from the person that made the diagnosis and said, if there's any blank, blank crazy in this room, it's you, and left. And 2 years later, I had a full breakdown. And, and here I am in 2009 suffering from things that got me in 67, 68, 69, and 70 and put me out of the Army. And so do you know how long it lasts? Chaplain, that's all I've got to say.
Thanks for your call, Ken.
All right.
Well, Ken, thank you very much. I want to thank you for your service, and I can hear your pain in what you say, and I appreciate your honesty. One of the things that was disenfranchising for me coming back was being in the inpatient PTSD program and seeing the Vietnam vets that I was in the therapy with, seeing how long they had suffered. I know there are aspects of what we have gone through that may heal and may not heal. And it's very tough.
Do you feel like this is something you're going to be dealing with for the rest of your life?
I think there are definitely aspects of this that will carry on. Even to this day, have a sleep disorder and a multitude of other symptoms. Now, the positive thing that is happening is people like me who are returning, there is more of an effort to put the resources out there, the helping resources to screen, and the people who are willing to say, yes, I am going through this, can get help. So they're not discarded for 20 or 30 years, much like the Vietnam population was. A lot of vets told me stories of them being put in padded rooms because the doctors didn't know what they were going through. And that's not what happens today. There are a lot more resources out there. So that's one hopeful piece of what we're going through. And right now I have so many resources, Wounded Warrior resources, that are assisting me to make it possible for me to be out of the military and function in society.
Your wife, Rebecca, who also contributes excerpts from her own journal throughout this thing to the book, has written that she's having to realize that the Roger she is married to today is not the Roger she married, not the Roger who graduated from seminary, and not the Roger who went off to war the first time. Can either one of you ever be as comfortable with the Roger you are now as the one you were before?
I think there are pros and cons to who I am today. I think one of the pros is as I am healing, as I do move closer to God, as I do move closer to my family, there is more of a refined love for my wife, for my kids, that I didn't necessarily have before the deployments. I think one of the big cons to which you're talking about is there are aspects of this that are very hard for her to deal with, and I can see myself going through it as I go through it, which, you know, part of it is the subdued nature, the coarseness, the not really wanting to let down my defenses, because in combat, when you let down your defenses, that's when, you know, you're more likely to be killed. So relearning how to function, I think that's a mourning process for her, both her and I, and my kids too. They've asked the questions, why does Daddy yell so much? And they don't understand. And they can't understand at this point. And so it's a grief process for our whole family.
It does seem exceptionally challenging to have to cope with a mental illness and be fully aware that you're dealing with it at the same time.
Yeah, you know, I've had a lot of people in my life that have invested in me, a lot of mentors, a lot of my clinical pastoral education supervisors that have worked with me in the chaplain field, both professionally and personally. And they're a contribution. Contributions from the people that love me, my family, have helped me to have somewhat of an awareness so that I can reach out for help and name those feelings of anger, of sorrow, sadness, whatever they may be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. My guest this hour is former U.S. Army Chaplain Roger Benimoff, whose new book is called Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. Let's go next to Wichita Falls and speak with Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, Mike.
How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Good. My son was in Mosul when they blew up the mess tent, and they went months and months and months eating bologna sandwiches, no hot meals in the snow, and it was terrible. And when they came back, I talked to a number of the soldiers that were furious with the Army, not with the Iraqis. Have you ministered to a lot of those soldiers that are still mad at the U.S. Army?
Yes, I have. We were actually supposed to go to that forward operating base in Mosul that was blown up. In fact, that was where our report site was. So I'm somewhat familiar with the details of that very, very, very sad situation. At the same time, I think what it really becomes about is the sense of helplessness that the soldier goes through, and trying to gain some control over their situation, and the army because it can account for everything is right in front of you, right in front of me. So, you know, oftentimes that becomes the brunt of it. It moves toward faith, anger at God, or anger at, you know, the army. And so part of the journey for me has been to say, what is that about? What is my anger really about? And for me, at least, it's been about that sense of helplessness, and the army should have taken care of me. The army, you know, much like God, why was this allowed to happen?
At one point when you were working at Walter Reed, you wrote in your journal, "I am a broken healer for broken soldiers in a broken system. God save us all." Is it getting better there?
I think the strength in what I do every day now is in my weakness, acknowledging both the pain that I've been through and the victory that I've been through, both together. That's what I've found that people want. People, when someone's dying, whether it's in the emergency trauma room here at Methodist or whether it's on the battlefield, they're not putting on a mask. They're being real. They want someone who can hear them into voice. They want someone who can become a mirror so they can be real. And that is that is the strength, being able to use my woundedness in a way that promotes healing.
Let's go next on the phone to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hi there. Thanks for the great show. My question for the guest is, does he believe that this war is supported by, advocated by, perhaps designed by his God? And I guess the other question that I would ask in following up with that is that beyond kind of a subjective based opinion and subsequent belief, how do you answer that question? Because I'm sure you get it. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
You know, theoretically, I could probably write a dissertation on that exact subject. I think where it hits home is where the theoretical concepts hit the practical, and what I mean by that is actually being in the midst of the crisis. You know, theoretically, I can justify, yeah, you know, free will, God allows us to choose our own course, man, you know, man versus man, etc. But I think where the real issue is, and where the rubber meets the road for me, is you know, if you can imagine being in an environment where your life is on the line every day. Now you have a set of feelings and emotions that have to be dealt with and reconciled.
Roger Benimoff is my guest. He's a former U.S. Army chaplain, currently serving as chaplain for Methodist Hospitals of Dallas. His new book is called Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. We do have a line open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can join us via email. That goes to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Roger Benimoff, a former U.S. Army chaplain whose new book is called Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You have an obligation under Christian doctrine to love your enemy as much as you love your friends and your family. When your enemy is someone who wants you dead in the immediate term, I wonder how much you struggled with that.
I struggled a lot with that. You know, it's, again, theoretically, it's easy for me to, and I learned in seminary and growing up in the Christian church that, you know, love your enemy, do good to those who want to harm you. And then when you're in that situation, when you're in that environment where someone literally wants to kill you, you know, you're stuck with your story. You're stuck with who you are as a person. And I think part of the healing process, moving from my return to where I'm at today, has been to accept the fact, you know, that I really didn't like this person, and allow God to work that peace in my life. And I think, again, being real was where the healing began in that area.
I know that you did work with a number of soldiers whose faith was irrevocably damaged by their experiences in the war. Do you feel like they have failed? Do you feel like God's failed them? Do you feel like, what's your perspective on people to whom that happens?
You know, I think life is a process, and It's much like a circular staircase. One of my supervisors used that analogy, where we often repeat the same issues, but we're at a different place in life when we do repeat our issues. And I think for those who are very angry and have questioned their faith, those are the faiths that are real. Even those who have walked away, I have to believe that God is still at work. And just like I walked away for a certain amount of time and shook my fist, God allowed me to walk back and move toward Him. When I look at the Bible, it's a story about God, humankind, sin and salvation, and it's a story about God moving toward people, people moving away from God, people moving toward God, and the pattern just continues.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Earl in Dallas. Hello, Earl.
There's a lot of talk about PTSD in this new war, and the thing that I never hear discussed, which I think has got to be a major factor, is the question of whether or not this is a just war. I mean, does that not affect the depth of PTSD? It's my personal belief that this is not a just war, and I believe that when I hear of all this PTSD that's going on, it must be harder to get over. It's obviously collateral damage is the biggest thing that, you know, besides terror itself, collateral damage has to be one of the biggest things that really affects people long term. But when it's collateral damage caused by a war that maybe shouldn't have even happened, that seems harder to get over.
Yeah, Roger, I know that when you first got back, you were greeted by a World War II veteran who said, "Today I am so proud of having liberated thousands of Jews from concentration camps, and I feel so good about my role." And you had this hollow sense that I don't have that.
Right, right. I think one of the ways I have worked through my feelings about the war is looking at specifically what I was able to do, what my unit was able to do
as an individual, as opposed to part of this big machine.
When we went to Tal Afar, no one was on the streets. Kids were not in the schools. Bodies were decapitated by the insurgents and left in the streets as a deterrent factor, so that the local population wouldn't work with the coalition forces. By the time we left, all the schools were open. The kids were back in school. They were running the street. The marketplace was busy. Not to say that the city was rid of insurgents, but we had made a difference. We impacted a group of people that this will carry on in their lives. Often what I do is I look at specific examples of what we were able to do. I was able to be there for my soldiers, and there's nothing more that I could have done. I cared for them emotionally and spiritually, and that was my job, and thank God I was able to do it.
I want to talk for a minute about some of the work that you were doing at Walter Reed. There were several cases where you met very well-meaning family members trying to care for a wounded soldier who didn't fully understand and didn't connect and tended to say exactly the wrong thing to people. Can you talk about what people do in their attempt to help wounded soldiers feel better that doesn't necessarily work?
Well, I think it's like that in most of the times where we're challenged with such an intense moment. When we see someone we love suffering, we don't want them to suffer. And as was the case with one of the moms that I worked with, a soldier who lost both limbs and was in a wheelchair. His wounds were not healing so that he could get prosthetics. And people who came in before him were able to get out before him and move on. And as you can imagine, he was very depressed. And the mom was attempting to cheer him up, and she was meaning well. Look at the good in this. Look at, you know, this and that. And the soldier was clearly not being heard. Part of my task part of what I've learned is, you know, it's not only my job to hear the soldier into speech, but hear the mother into speech. What she is going through is just as vivid as what the soldier's going through. She's going through a grieving process. And so part of what I need to do in that moment is respect where the mom is at and hear her into words.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Matthew in McKinney. Hey, Matthew.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd first like to thank your guest for his service to our country. So thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I would also like to ask, I'm planning on joining the military as soon as I graduate from college, and I would like to know, would God be angry with me if I were to kill another person, whether it be an enemy insurgent or an accidental innocent civilian? I would like to know.
Well, Matthew, I'm gonna challenge you on this one, and I'm gonna ask you to look at your faith, look at where what you've been taught, and where you're at in your life now with your faith, because I believe that's a question that I can't answer for you. Something that you're going to have to search out the piece around that question.
What do you, in terms of your relationship with your wife, how do you have to try harder now, in terms of things you didn't even have to think about before? You mentioned having a more refined love for your wife and your children. If I heard you correctly, that means it's sometimes more effort than it was the first time around.
Yes, it is. Right now, I'm working in a hospital system, and most of the day, what I do is listening and a little talking. And hopefully, I try to listen more than I talk. And when I get home, I know that my wife has spent the day taking care of all the things that she takes care of, and being with our kids, and she needs adult conversation. So something as simple as going home and listening, I have to not only remind myself, but I have to work at being there, being present, not trying to fix it for her. Because that's part of the thing about PTSD, is the out-of-controlness. And so it'd be easy to overcompensate and say, well, here's what you need to do, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so it does take more work. But I think, like the other day, my wife was sharing an issue with me. And, you know, I was able to listen to her and reflect back what she was saying, but reflect back in a way that invited her to know that I was listening, and invited her to figure it out for herself. And that was very moving, because I don't know that I could have done that before the deployments.
Is there part of you that thinks, I'm still healing myself, I have to get away from people and their problems, and I should go, you know, work at Best Buy or become an accountant or do something that isn't so emotionally draining, so that I can get back on my feet psychologically?
Well, you know, I would go back to the process of healing. In college, I worked general construction for 4 years. And I think right now in my life, I'm too much of a wimp to go back to that. you know, there are people who say, "What are you doing back in a trauma center? Why are you putting yourself through this?" And I think part of the healing process has been to invest in others what's been invested in me, and that is the being able to be vulnerable, have a healthy amount of vulnerability, and invite people who are in those end stages of life, or who have just gone through the traumas of, you know, the family members who've gone through the traumas of death, and invite them to express where they're at and walk with them through that tumultuous time.
If you could make a change in the way that the U.S. Cares for soldiers who have returned from war, whether or not they're immediately showing signs of PTSD or other battle injuries, what would it be?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the CARE piece. I know when I got back, I was thrust right into designing a program to help reorient soldiers. My unit come back from Iraq, and I did that the first 2 months. So I didn't really have a break. I went from a day in combat to planning this huge program for 4,000 soldiers and spouses and et cetera. I think one of the things that I would like to see is the military being able to provide that retreat, that space for the caregivers as well as the soldiers to be able to get one-on-one help in an environment, in a setting that is away from the base, let's say.
Well, your little boys are still quite young, but I wonder, you know, you mentioned that they've said, why is Dad yelling all the time? How much have you tried to explain to them about what you've been through?
Well, I think my wife has done a wonderful job. She has actually got some literature that story tells about a father having difficulty, and in childlike terms, talks about the difficulty. I think another thing I try to do with my children is apologize when I do lose my temper or something like that, and I think in my vulnerability, they're able to see my humanity and see that, you know, we're not going to have it all together all the time, and I think that's one of the best life lessons that I can give them as a father, is to admit when I do blow it.
Do you envy the other dads on the soccer field who are able to approach parenting without this simultaneous weight of trauma?
You know, I think there are pros and cons to this. I would like to look at the piece of my story that invites me to move closer to my kids in a way that I couldn't do that before, and I believe that, you know, this today I'm more able to go home and hug and kiss Tyler and Blaine and look them in the eye and tell them I love them and spend quality time with them versus sitting on the couch and, you know, getting engrossed in regular life and losing focus.
Roger Benimoff is the chaplain at Methodist Hospitals of Dallas. His new book is called Faith Under Fire, an Army Chaplain's Memoir. Roger, it's been a really fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.